At this time, I would like to introduce our speaker, Moore. Moore has been a light in my life since I've been coming to DA, and he makes me laugh. He has a beautiful story, and I'm so glad he's here. Moore, you're up.
Thanks, Shauna. I'm Moore, an addict in recovery with symptoms of other addictions. I see that my internet is unstable, so I'm going to put my camera off and see if that will help. So I'm going to share how it was, what I did, and how it is today, laced through with hope. And I was the eldest of four. My mother and father got married, I guess, a little bit late. They were 35 when they got married. And everything was normal, I suppose, growing up in my early years. I come to think now that as infants and children, at some level, what is going on in our early life is all we know. So from that point of view, it's normal. But I also have heard it said that when an infant is born, the only thing that it needs is love, with what's other requirements, and that if an infant isn't getting that, it is aware that it's not getting parental love. And this can sort of, I believe, set up a kind of hypervigilance, a caution, you know, an instinctual caution. So I was the eldest of four, and my father was an architect. So I guess we were, you know, we were kind of middle class. Grew up in the leafy suburbs in a place called Jordanstown, just outside Belfast. And, you know, one of my first memories of feeling uncomfortable, I have this memory of walking home from primary school on the left-hand side of the road. And it was a wee small secondary road. So it was only 15 or 16 or 18 foot wide. And across on the other side, there was a guy, three people who were out of my class, and they were walking home together. And they seemed to be laughing and having fun. And I remember thinking, why am I on my own here? And they are together, and yet we're only feet apart. And I guess we don't all have the same chances in life. And all we can do is our best. And all our parents can do is their best. And you know, I think there was an element of dysfunctionality in my family. My father, I would say, did have a problem with alcohol. Although in his later years, he was able to drink relatively small amounts. But I remember from a young age, my mother sitting playing patience at night when Dad didn't come home, and there was a tension in the house. And then, even still, while at primary school, picking snippets up and the mood in the house. And the next day, I remember my father used to drive to work at that time, and he would have left his car and got home in a taxi. And I remember my mother used to send a couple of us, dad, on a Saturday morning or whatever it was, to go back into Belfast to get his car. And I came to realize that she did that as a kind of an insurance policy so that he didn't start again. And so that was, I guess, a factor in my database as I grew up. And I would say, but maybe we all have different chances in life. And what if life is for being the best you can from no matter where you start? And I would put it like this, I read somewhere that by the time you're age 23, one should have stopped blaming one's parents for the problems that we have. And I still hadn't doing that when I was 53, if I blame my parents and my parents blame their parents, and their parents blame their parents, and the whole thing goes back until it's Adam and Eve's fault. And there's absolutely nothing we can do about that. That is life. And that's what I try to accept now, that this is it. It's up to me. The lock of depression opens from the inside, and this the belief that we have as Depressed Anonymous, that we sadden ourselves, is a very difficult pill to swallow, but there is a lot of sense in it. We moved house as a family, and I think there was money. We ended up selling the house that we were in and moved in with my grandmother, and that was quite, there was stress in that too, because she didn't like my father's drinking. And then there was the stress of him not coming home and my mother getting stressed, and that didn't work. And then an aunt of my father's died, and we ended up moving into her house. And I ended up then, we left this nice area, and we weren't a bad part of Belfast, but I guess I look back and I think that to do well in school does take a bit of preparation by one's parents. I think, and I guess, part of me wants to blame, but the other part comes back to this part. Well, this is your life. At some stage, you have to forget about blaming and get on with it. And back to some of us have different chances than others. And I think I didn't do well at school. And I think part of that, of course, there was four children, so my parents were pretty, my mother was pretty busy. If my father didn't come home at night, she was doing everything. So I think, there is an element of parents preparing their children so that when they go to school, they're in a frame of mind that they're prepared to listen and learn. And I wasn't. I was a daydreamer. just kept looking out the window, didn't want to be there, wanted to be outside. And as a result, as a result, I didn't pass the first exam and ended up in a school that, well, another friend described it as a zoo, but it was a very rough school. And I had been brought up sort of in a middle class area and ended up in this quite rough school with a catchment that had, a class wise, I guess, people who had a more difficult financial upbringing than I had had. So I was a bit of a snob, and that didn't bode well. It's hard, as I heard somebody once say, when you're in a class and people are doing better than you, it's hard to be a snob when everybody else is doing better than you. And I didn't really fit in, so I became a target for bullying. And I do remember also thinking that this thought, why would I start to fight and destroy my clothes that my parents bought me, all this. So that was the start of my reacting to other people by removing myself from other people. If I could avoid people, then I didn't get bullied. And that started a behavioral pattern that was really avoid people. And I've shared this before. Like I rem at that for a long time at that school, I would, I didn't want to get up in the morning. I would hear my mother coming and shouting. Remember, you'd come up the stairs with a brush, banging it off the stairs, and then off the bed to get me up. And I would get up the last minute and jump on a bike and cycle to school and go in. But I was nearly always late, and the prefects had gotten to know me. And I would walk into the assembly, which was just starting, and I think everybody sort of accepted it. And I didn't realize for many years why I did that. And then I came to realize that the reason I did that was I was the last one into the assembly at this school. So therefore, I was the first one out. And I could get to the relative safety of a classroom without having to encounter anybody else because I was the first out the door. And when I look at socializing now, I see kids getting going to school early and going to the shop together, and it was all completely foreign to me. So I couldn't wait to get out of school. And I became Fair, I really, started working at a young age, selling papers at 13 or 14, and was, I guess, at some level, my parents accepted that, for I hadn't excelled academically anyway, and certainly for me, work became a reason for I got a feeling of great worth out of being able to work, do things, achieve things, earn money, and that became a driver, I think. Along with I had discovered, well, we'd been my brothers and My brother and sisters and myself had been sampling drink from we were quite young. We and alcohol became a problem for me. I even before I left school, I was drinking uncontrollably. Now, I wasn't an alcoholic at that stage, but looking back, I can see that when I started, I would keep drinking, you know, I guess because I had this feeling of, oh, I can do this, and, you know, it made me feel better and whatnot. But I got into a lot of trouble with alcohol and being drunk and getting locked up and all those things, losing jobs. But I didn't see it as a problem, as many of us, I would say, would be the same in a society where alcohol is sort of accepted. And it's very easy to get on that slippery slope. And the workaholic, alcoholic, it's an obsession, I guess, that gives some feel-good feeling. Relationship-wise, as a teenager, you know, looking back, I can see that I was interested in girls and, you know, had girlfriends. Although I remember at 16, somebody was, when I was at a training for to be an apprentice at 16, one of the guys had moved in with a girl, and I thought, what? Moved in? What's that all about? You know, I had absolutely no concept of what a relationship was about. You know, many, many years later, I came to regret that I didn't know that, you know, having a girlfriend was about building a relationship to maybe build a family on it, you know. And it just, I was always afraid of commitment. Where would I get the money? And, you know, it just didn't sit with me at all. So that was something that became a source of regret, I guess. And again, I don't know, where does this, where do we learn this? I don't know. I think lust is, it's a big, it's a factor in life, big time. And, you know, it makes sure that we have plenty more coming behind us. So it does. So, the alcohol, as I say, was a problem. I long periods off alcohol, and you know, I remember I was a lorry driver, a long distance lorry driver, and I went off alcohol because I knew that I couldn't trust myself being on a boat where I knew that at some stage I would wake up a mess. So I knew I had a problem, and you know, as my life progressed, you know, it was trying to work out what the problem is. Is it not, you know, for a while I thought it was, oh, if I'm in a proper relationship, that's what I'm looking for. Well, I'll go and see a therapist, go and see a psychiatrist. And eventually, you know, I worked so hard. I worked myself to breakdown, basically. And, you know, at this stage still believed that work was so virtuous that even though I had resigned from one job, I was straight back out in another job very quickly. And just, I had a sort of an overwhelming breakdown and ended up seeing a doctor and being prescribed antidepressants. In my mid to late 30s, and I've struggled with medication. I'm still on medication. I'm on 200 milligrams of sertraline a day. And that started me I guess going to see therapists, psychiatrists, and those sort of things, as I've said, with I like the saying, nothing is wasted, you know. But, you know, having been through a session and looking back, I always felt, well, that didn't solve it, you know. And trying other things, so, you know, it was, I guess for me, a lot of my feeling of worth, as I said, was got out of vocation. And I drove myself quite hard, you know. I became a pilot and then a commercial pilot, and I had to give that up in the end because of self-medicating with antidepressants and alcohol. And it took me a long time to realize that that I hadn't the ability at that particular time to do that. And that was in my 50s, and it came as a real crash to me, you know, when I realized that I was going to have to give this dream up of, I had applied for the dream job working for the government aircraft, and I didn't get the job. And with that came the most horrendous breakdown, deflation, loss of wanting to live. And along with that came also an inheritance that was particularly challenging too at that particular time. You know, I got so fearful. I couldn't go out. I couldn't even watch the TV. couldn't concentrate on it. And I remember I had a wee Springer Spaniel at the time, and I was sitting, and those of your dog owners will know that dogs they want to come and be close to you and lick your lips if you let them. And I remember sitting there and him coming and licking me, and whatever he could taste, the fear that I can taste as a sort of a metallic taste in my mouth. And that wee dog, he just put his head down, his tail down, his wee eyes rolled away and his head went down, and he skulked away from me. And I'll never forget that. That wee dog knew that the leader of the pack wasn't well and that he was afraid. And, you know, I can see now how the dog world works to some degree, where they're constantly licking each other's lips. They know if there's fear in another dog from what they taste, I believe, you know. And I guess from that came the darkest days. I came to the darkest days. I'm trying to think ahead here that I should be talking 51% about recovery. So I'm not sure, am I halfway through, Stacey, or what way am I time-wise?
You're at about 12 minutes left.
So, okay. Well, I'm going to have to talk about the recovery. Anyhow, this was the start of the realization that something was going to have to change. I had given up alcohol. I'd realized already that I could never, personally, I could never find a resolution in my mind if I continued to take mood-altering substances. That was me. I don't know if it's the same for anybody else. So I stopped drinking. I was still taking the antidepressants, and I got to a place where I hang in bed and wanted to hang myself, planned how I was going to hang myself. I would get a rope from the van and tie the rope onto the handle of the door and put a noose in it and step off the kitchen steps on the other side. And when I went through to the next thing, I thought, well, if I kill myself, the shame that I am going to leave behind will be worse for my family than if I just stand up and say, I'm Moore and I'm in my 50s. And you know what? At 50, I have to stand up and say, you know what? I don't know how to live. I have been following a way of living that seemed right to me at the time, but I see that it's not right today. And part of that came from thinking about my niece and nephews, that if I kill myself, what I have learnt about the journey, I will not be able to pass on to them. And they thought of helping others with what I had learned came after that. So though that was my spiritual awakening, if you like, that was my moment of clarity. And I had been attending AA, and I started to hear the language that we never hear spoken about. I started to hear people talking about fears that I could identify with. I could, you know, back then, you know, I couldn't have spoken like this. If I had to speak, I had to write everything down. And it was the inability to trust myself to open my mouth. And at a subconscious level, I wouldn't speak because I didn't know what I would say. I was afraid I would embarrass myself. You know, there was a fear of, there was stuff inside me that, you know, I couldn't talk about. So I was afraid to talk because, you know, because maybe I, and this was all subconscious, you know, it was a subconscious thing. But having gone to 12-step fellowship and hearing a language spoken that I had never heard, you know, at home any time I tried to talk about the thoughts that were in my head, it was dismissed. Oh no, there's, you know, is this sort of, oh, we don't talk about things like that, you know. And ironically now, you know, I think that this is the most important thing, that we do talk about the thoughts that are in our head. And I got into service. I went through the steps on three different occasions with sponsors. And, you know, whether that's right or wrong, each time I learned more. And by going through the steps and working with a sponsor and continuing to go to meetings, I realized that, you know, I was not on my own, that the mind, I put it like layers, Bill, of dysfunctionality and neurosis, I guess, build up and build up and build up and build up. And because they build up in layers, I believe now they can come back down in layers. You know, I thought I was broken. I thought I was defective. I thought there was no chance. How could I ever get to a place where I would be comfortable? But I have. And, you know, I've been to psychiatrists. I come into some money. I went to Harley Street, and the Centre of Excellence for Psychiatry, private psychiatry in London. And, you know, I did meet a very, very good psychotherapist who spoke to me about shame. And, you know, that helped me a lot when there was some degree of understanding shared with me about shame and how corrosive shame can be, and how somebody who is depressed or dependent will even attach shame onto good things because of whatever. That's how our mind is working as the layers build up. And today, you know, DA is, you know, my DA is my psychiatrist.
Hey, more than a 5-minute warning.
Thank you. DA is my psychotherapist. And you know what? This feeling that I had, you know, when I was searching high and low for help, always at the back of my mind was this thought, but why is there no help closer to home? You know, why do I have to go to this person? Why do I have to run to there? And of course, that was answered eventually, you know, when I found the fellowships. There was recovery right on my doorstep in my town. It's right here today at this meeting as we gather together. Non-professional people were, as far as mental health is concerned, addiction. It's non-professionals who come together and are not afraid to talk about the thoughts that go on in their head. Today, this is where my recovery comes from. It comes from you. You know, and I heard another speaker share, you know, all I did was go to the meetings and listen to what you told me. And now I'm here today telling you what you told me. And I love that, you know, that as a group, as a fellowship, we make suggestions to each other. We suggest you go to 6 meetings. We suggest you get a sponsor and do the steps. We suggest that you get into service. We suggest you keep coming to meetings. And ironically, it's all written down. We don't have to think about it. All we have to do is to open our mind up. And that's all I had to do, was to open my mind up when I went to the meetings and listened to what others were saying. I could feel hope coming from what other people were telling me. And they were just ordinary people. They weren't professionals, but they came from every profession in the world. But they came together and were prepared to talk about how it was, what they did, and how it is now. And there's so much comfort for me today to know that at 5:30 in Ireland, I can throw up the computer and get onto a meeting and listen to the strength and hope that comes from other people sharing the thoughts that go on in their head. So I guess the hope is, the irony is, the pain comes first. Pain is the touchstone for change. And coming from being a person who isolated and thought that others were the problem, that to accept the fact that actually they're reacting to what I do, I am the problem, is a very difficult pill to start to swallow. Because it means that I have to, if I want to stay in recovery, I have to listen to what other people say and not stay in my head, because there's no reality in my head. If I stay in my head, I'm in delusion. But if I come to meetings and share, if there's delusion coming out of my mouth, some of you will tell me. And it's only by connecting with ourselves that the hope builds, the feeling of recovery strengthens, you know, and with that, you know, I guess I'll keep coming back. So with that, I'll share the time. Thank you.